Welcome to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder
and Josh Hughes.
This podcast may contain swearing, plus it will be filled with lots of interesting chat.
All the views are expressed are our own and are not those of our institutions or employers. You're welcome to share your own views in the comment box on the website.
And if you like what you hear, please like, share and subscribe. And you can find out more on our website, innerzonepodcast.com.
Or on Spotify, iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also like us on Facebook.
So, without further ado, here's this week's episode. So, hello and welcome to the In The Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
In today's episode, there's a dog barking in the background as we're recording this, we're going to return to the In The Zone book club to talk about Man Plus by Frederick Pohl.
Yeah, so you've told me a little bit about this book and it sounds really interesting, the story about computers and understanding of human beings and what it means to be human in some ways, but...
Yeah, I mean, there's loads to it. I mean, I think I mentioned it previously, because I mentioned it, like, it's in my thesis as one part, but I also am a big fan of Frederick Pohl, because I've actually recently written an article, which is going to be published soon, about some of Frederick Pohl's other stuff. So for those of you who don't know, Frederick Pohl is perhaps one of, I think you could say, the biggest, most influential names in science fiction, not just as a writer. I mean, he's written books, including The Space Merchants, which is another big famous book of his, and with... Cyril Cornbluth, as well as books such as Gateway, which is another book on my shelf over there. But he's also had a really significant role as an editor in actually shaping modern sci-fi, as it were, sort of by giving voices to certain writers and certain theories and ideas and things. So actually, he's just as significant as an editor as he is as a writer. And actually, for this reason, you could definitely put him up there, I think. And as it goes, he's been quite, I think, critically underrepresented compared to, say, the likes of Heinlein, Le Guin, sort of, Philip K. Dick, even, for his ideas. He's got a lot of interesting stuff out there, but as I say, he's a very interesting man. But so his book, Man Plus, came in 1976, and it follows the journey of the protagonist called Roger Torroway. And the book sort of takes a stance where the narrator is very sort of a scientific narration, where it's like a scientific report about Roger Torroway's journey. And so the idea is that they need to put humans on Mars. And so there's an experiment underway where they're trying to basically repurpose this man to be on Mars. But what happens is Torroway initially isn't the central person for this experiment, it's actually someone else. But the person they're initially doing this experiment on dies. And so Roger Torroway gets put forward as the new candidate for the Man Plus program. And what happens is he undergoes a series of surgeries and processes by which eventually he gets turned, not from anything even remotely, he gets turned from being human into something not even remotely near to what you call human. I mean, just looking at the front cover of the book, it's a pretty interesting picture. You've got, it's almost sort of mutant...
It's like a giant bug, isn't it?
Insect thing. Yeah, I mean, he's physically got two arms and two legs, and I mean, that's about as human as it is, really. So he's got these big crystalline eyes, like a fly, as it were, and he's got sort of wings, and his musculature is different, and they've had to completely sort of change his skin, and obviously he's had sort of new lungs so he can sort of process the really low levels of oxygen and all this sort of stuff. And he's also got this idea of technology mediation as well. So he's designed to basically be self-sufficient on Mars, so he can survive in the environments of Mars without all the buildings and stuff. He can survive literally, like, as you say, almost without a spacesuit. As it goes, when I first talked about this book in my thesis, I sort of read it alongside things like Starship Troopers and Forever War, in the sense of, in those books you have these soldiers who are put in these technological suits through which they can fight in these distant wars. And the idea with Man Plus, as I read these books side by side, is that, well, actually, in a way, the Man Plus in this book actually is the suit. He becomes the suit. So there's no separating him from the technology. He is a new sort of creation, this new sort of being. So anyway, as the sort of series of surgeries sort of unfolds, they eventually get to the point where Roger Torroway gets sent to Mars to do sort of a series of sort of tasks or whatever. This is towards the end of the book. But then the big twist, sort of hate to give away plot spoilers, but it's important for the whole novel, is actually...
Yeah, so at this point, if you want to read the book, you should pause the podcast.
Yeah, pause the podcast now. So the big twist is actually the narration that you've been reading all along, which is very much as if it's from a group of scientists talking about what's happening to Roger Torroway. It's very sort of dispassionate. It's very much almost looking at something in a petri dish. It's really interesting the way it's narrated. But the narrator is revealed to be a computer and or series of computers, like a collective of computers. And so actually the whole set of circumstances that's led to the Man Plus program and led to Roger Torroway being turned from a normal human being, normal human man, into this weird insect-like, almost alien entity who's barely human at all, if you can even argue that, has been manipulated by a series of computers, essentially, to because they want to protect their own survival. So they want to ensure that they can be moved, not just from Earth, but to Mars, to get them away from Earth, so that sort of the computer technology can continue.
Mm.
So it's almost like a sort of biological imperative, what you might call a biological imperative for survival in the sort of this race of computers that are subtly influencing Earth-based politics to manipulate a new program to get humans to go to Mars, and then to need, then for the new Man Plus to need computer intervention in order to process all the information that he's getting. So he's got this sort of technological mediator for his senses, and the idea that actually he needs to have all these computer connections, so he has to take computers with them, and then the computer sort of satellite and all this stuff. So it gets really fascinating towards the end, and how computers essentially are really critical in the whole direction of travel for this novel. And once you get to that twist, it gives you a completely new perspective on all that's happened in the book up to that point, because you're reading it obviously through a human lens initially, and there's no hint that the narrator is in any way not a human, until it is that you get to the end and you realise actually it's the computers that have been manipulating things all along. And they've even manipulated the political climate to influence like the president and things, to actually sanction the project and allow for this project to get pushed forward. Because there's a point where even where the project might not go ahead, they might not even send them to Mars. But they manipulate things such that the data is such that the humans think that they're doing it of their own volition, but actually they've been controlled by the computers all along.
Right, wow. That sounds like a good story.
Yeah, I do love my sci-fi books, yeah. As you all know.
But I mean, the issue of sort of machines influencing politics and I suppose it provides a link to what a lot of people think is sort of happening these days with the phrase technological capitalism is something that I've read recently.
Mm.
In that, whereas 10, 15 years ago, we were kind of capitalism and international business was kind of you did whatever the market said, whereas now it's kind of you do whatever the machines say.
Right.
And so in that way, the machines kind of have this influence and this control over what's happening.
Yeah.
Of course, we know that it's the algorithm, it's the underlying algorithms that make these choices and apply these decisions. Mm. And so what it indicates to me, all that kind of thing, is about there's something in there about how human beings can't program algorithms to take enough data points to make a real fundamentally big decision or a fully rounded decision. Mm. And it links to other stuff as well that we'll probably come on to. So how does the book discuss how these machines make their choices or apply decisions about what should happen to the person in terms of what should happen what should happen to them in order to survive on Mars?
Well, this is a good question. So obviously they've got an idea of the things that are required to exist on Mars. So you've got to be able to survive the temperature, survive the cold temperature. You've got to be able to sort of breathe, essentially. So they've got to do all that sort of stuff. And so the metabolism has to be changed as well. But then there's all this other stuff, which isn't really quite justified. And on reflection is maybe a justification in order to use more technology. But so they give him all these sort of advanced vision and hearing and stuff. I suppose in a way to make him this self-sufficient individual, so he doesn't rely on other people as well. But in doing so, he has this abundance of data coming into his brain. And the reason that the previous candidate for the experiment dies is that the overabundance of data essentially sort of fries his brain. So they have to insert this sort of computer mediation to the stuff that comes in to him. And so he's always a subject of sort of scientific experiments. But what I do find particularly interesting here is that the scientists who are working on him, they think that they've got in complete control. But actually, as it turns out, those scientists are themselves being manipulated by the machines. And so there's this sense that even the scientists are just as much an altered human as Roger Torroway is, because they're just as a victim, as it were. I say victim, but they're sort of, they're as much beholden to the sort of means of others as Roger Torroway is, even though they don't undergo the same bodily transformation.
I suppose that's interesting, because it provides another link to what we see happening today in terms of sort of, what should we say? So, whether you interact online, all your data about you is collected, and it creates what's called an abstract identity. So, kind of your data self, as it were. How advertisers can assume you as a you, Mike, as a white man living in the north, is interested in sci-fi. What type of things would you be interested in that they can advertise to you?
Yeah.
And so for a lot of people, that leads to, or at least to ideas about being controlled by machines, because we are obviously influenced by advertising somewhat. Mm. So in that way, you can see a parallel between the average person nowadays being influenced by targeted advertising and the machines influencing the scientists in the book.
Yeah, and finding ways to manipulate them to the point where they don't even realise they're being manipulated. I think it's like the thing where you get with Google search, where a lot of people, yeah, we know that Google collects our data, but they don't necessarily know that the data they're being presented with is filtered through a certain mediative process, to which point, especially like a lot of my students now, they don't realise that you're not showing what is out there. You're being shown a sort of selection of what's out there based on assumptions about what you want to see. Yeah. It's not what you need to see, So it's not a clear representation of what you're looking for, but it's a representation on what Google thinks you want to see, because the whole of the internet really works on this concept of validation bias, where you get this sort of filter bubble where Google, because to make you continue using Google, you see the things that Google thinks you want to see, which then gives you this whole sort of cycle where really the things that you see are shaped essentially by advertising engines.
Yeah, and you sort of mentioned that computer interface.
Yeah.
Idea. In terms of the information that we receive from Google or from Facebook or Instagram or Twitter or Reddit, or you know, name your new technology service, is filtered according to what they think we will like.
Yeah, mediated perception. Yeah, very much.
And so obviously you've already mentioned some of the technologically mediated aspects of Man Plus.
Yeah.
So do you think? I suppose that there are the technological mediation in Man Plus is about the character's physical interaction with Mars.
Yeah, so his perception of the world is mediated eventually through, because they change all his senses and stuff, there's this mediation between his insect-like eyes, so the data that's coming in through his eyes, and then how his brain processes it and what he perceives. Of course, there's a second layer to this book, which is particularly interesting, in that the book, as we read it, is mediated by the machines. So when you read it initially, you think the narrator's just like the scientist. So because as human readers, we assume that the narrator is a human being. Obviously, you then find it's been mediated by machines. And so therefore, you realise that your perceptions of the book itself has been mediated by a set of machines. So there's a decision-making process that's mediated your own perception of the story of the book. This actually ties quite interestingly with my previous discussion about Flowers for Algernon, and the idea that it's a diary. So because it's a diary, the idea is that the person writing the diary has made a selection of what's going in the book, above and beyond what you might expect in any old sort of other normal book. And then obviously when Charlie becomes aware that people are reading his diary, he then changes how he's writing the book. Obviously, again, there's an even more meta filter there, wherein it's the author has decided what the filter is. But the assumption is here that when you're reading this book, you're entering a world in which you are reading what you think is ostensibly a scientific report, but it's not. It's a report by a load of machines, and then it gets very interesting at the end, and it completely makes you reassess all the stuff that you've been fed before. And really, when you go back to read it again, I'm sure if I did so again now, I'd have a slightly different take on the things that happen. There's a really interesting part, especially when they're doing experiments, when they're doing these surgeries on Roger Torroway, and after one of the many experiments he goes through, he finds they basically just cut off his penis. And But the thing is, the scientists didn't even think to tell him that they were going to do this, because to them, and i.e. the machines who are controlling it, it's just an appendage. But to him, there's a big sort of social, psychological implication to what that process means.
Mm.
So to him, it's a real symbol of his still connection to humanity. So for him, it's just like, well, it's needless weight, isn't it? It's just, you don't need it. It's just completely unnecessary. Because he's never going to reproduce again. So there's no need from a reproductive point of view. And he's going to live on Mars, so he's not coming back to Earth. So the idea is you don't need it, so we're just going to cut it off.
I suppose that's interesting. It's a clear example of extreme rationality.
Yes.
In the sense that it ignores the qualitative understanding of qualitative view that people have of the world, in that there's an internal qualitative understanding about who you are and for
what it means.
Yeah, what it means, yeah.
Yeah, to be human.
Yeah, and obviously for men.
Yeah, and for men, but just more generally, I think there's a sense that as a society we do tie our expectations of humanity to a certain idea of gender. I know obviously there are lots of sort of counters as well to that, but there's an idea that wherever you stand on what you think about sort of gender roles or whatever, the idea is there is still a essential notion of male and female that sort of guides a lot of our thinking about who we are. And here, you're right, it's kind of like a rationality taken to the nth degree, which is interesting as well when you think about the timing of this book and sort of the end of the mid-70s. Obviously, Vietnam's just come to an end, but you've got this massive period just prior to this of this sort of massive focus on rationality and running war by numbers and this obsession with machines and machines sort of filtering their way into things like marketing and the way that we push products to people, the way that we can use data to give better, so inverted commas, better results to mean we can target people better with information and that we can sell more things to them, but we can shape their lives essentially. And you're right, here the man plus has been shaped so much by the world around him, but he's no longer the sort of the man that he once was. Mm-hmm. He's not a man plus at all. He's more, if anything, he's a man minus as opposed to a man plus, which is an interesting sort of double take on the title.
Yeah. And I think, as you mentioned there about the Vietnam War, in the sense of, that was the sort of, the understanding of that war as sort of a cybernetic system, which lots of the US top brass tried to do, it's obviously, it's dependent upon accurate data.
Yeah,
and what we saw in the Vietnam War was that lots of the data was inaccurate because you can't really use a soldier or a marine who's being shot at to accurately collect data because they've got other things to think about.
Yeah,
and also maybe they want to say they've got a better kill count.
Yeah, body count.
Body count than they have, or they perform better, or we had to retreat because of. There were 5,000 Viet Cong coming when really there weren't that many, or something. Mm. It all depends on accurate data.
Yeah, and understanding that data and what it means.
And yes, absolutely. And taking into account errors in recording.
Yeah.
So do you find any of that kind of those ideas or that discussion within the book?
Well, yeah, it comes into it a bit in the end, mainly when it comes to the factors that have led the sort of the human race to want to go to Mars. So there's this idea that the computers have been subtly influencing the numbers when it comes to the decision making in the politics of the government that's funding this series of experiments, series of surgeries, this Man Plus program. So it's the idea that there's no one single decision that the computers have made, but what they've done is they've been subtly altering the numbers just by a really little bit, just to eventually lead them to make the decision to go to Mars. Because there's a point where they won't go to Mars. But the idea is that controlling all the numbers across the globe, so actually the idea that numbers themselves really almost are meaningless then, because they're shaping the behaviour of everyone here to ultimately lead to this project and this humankind going to Mars. So there's that element, I suppose. But then there's also this element to which Roger Tolway's perceptions themselves are filtered through numbers that may or may not be accurate, or through sort of computer data. Because there's a point as well where the narrator, and i.e. the computers, as it turns out, they decide that these sort of sovereign rulers of the goings-on within the world of this novel, they decide that because Roger Torroway doesn't want to do a certain thing they want on Mars, to ensure that he does what they want him to do, they project this hologram of his wife, or his former wife as it is really, and he obviously thinks it's her, but actually they're using this to psychologically manipulate him to behave in a certain way. And so they're relying on his predisposition to believe this this woman who he is sort of intimately, sort of emotionally connected with, over them just telling him to do something. So there's this idea too that he doesn't even know the difference between reality and fiction, because they're creating fictionalized versions of the world to alter his behavior, which in itself is also fascinating as well, because it's like, well, at what point do you know that anything is real? Because it's all ultimately filtered through some sort of means of perception.
Mm. I suppose that's the problem of postmodernism in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, well, everything's filtered through various lenses. Even us sort of sitting here now, people listening to this podcast, they'll be listening through certain mobile devices, which themselves shape the way that we perceive the world and the things that we're listening to.
Mm. Yeah, and I suppose what's interesting as well is you mentioned a couple of times about how the machines in this book influence politics to allow all this stuff to happen and the continuation of the machines. So there's obviously this underlying idea that machines will become, become sentient in a way.
Yeah, that in itself is interesting, because the way it's presented in the book, there doesn't seem to be any understanding on the part of the humans that this is what's happened. So it's almost like they're wandering blindly, not realising that the computers are having more say, or they're more alive than you think they are. Yeah. Which in itself is quite an interesting take compared to other books of the sort of 60s and 70s, where it's very clear that the computer has become alive. Raises this massive question of, well, what point is something sentient? And then, well, how should we think about these machines?
Yeah, so, I think we've done that before on the podcast, haven't we? But it's interesting that it's just assumed. It's kind of underlying. Because you see in a lot of modern sort of technology journalism, this kind of assumption that, oh yeah, in 5-10 years, machines will just be, they'll be living and they'll be more advanced than us. And it's kind of almost like it goes unquestioned a lot of the time. And it's fair enough in sci-fi, because it's an imagined reality, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when it comes to actual reality, you sort of see this, lots of people writing in Wired or in The Verge, or
those are popular tech thing.
It's like there's this unwavering belief, that machines will, just because technology progresses exponentially, or has done recently, because of Moore's law and whatever, that one day
it'll be the case.
And I think we've discussed it before in the podcast how that idea is fundamentally flawed.
Yeah, very much so.
It's interesting that it's just sort of assumed.
Yeah, it's weird actually, because it's not something that's directly addressed, whether these machines are alive or not. Because I think as readers, we assume, I think that's part of the interesting thing, because the whole book you're reading, assuming you're just reading a human's scientific report until you get to the end and you realise it's the machine. But they never actually stop to reflect on whether the machines themselves are alive. Because the thing with the machines, when they start talking as machines right towards the very end, is it's all just about the reason for this decision is ultimately self-preservation. And this idea that, well, the world might fall into nuclear war or whatever, so we need to preserve ourselves against threats. We need to replicate, we need to reproduce key systems on Mars. To do this, we're going to do X, Y, Z. It almost ties back to the iRobot idea of the three laws of robotics, and as well as this idea of self-preservation. And so in this case, the machines have just decided, well, okay, so we need to stay living, we need to stay alive, or alive, functioning, that's probably the best way to say it. We need to stay functioning, so therefore, we need to take these logical steps. I don't know that necessarily really means that the machines are what we might think of as alive or not, actually.
Yeah.
It might just be a series of algorithmic decisions to say, okay, we need to reproduce, we need to stay alive, we need to stay functioning. To stay functioning, we need to put backup on Mars. To do this, we'll do X, Y, Z. Are they really sentient? I don't know, because the book doesn't really go into that. However, the book does imply, by the very fact that we read it as being written by humans, it does imply that there is some sort of higher thought there.
Mm. I suppose what's interesting is that ideas of survival and continuation are obviously inherently human.
Yeah.
But there isn't actually a need to put that into a machine, because it doesn't actually matter if, you know, I turn my computer off.
Mm.
What does it matter? You know, one day I'll turn the computers that I own, I'll turn them off and never use them again.
Yeah.
And that doesn't matter.
No.
But it's interesting that these machines in this book are imbued with that human, that very sort of central element of human nature of survival.
Yeah.
And whether that's, we often talk about sort of algorithmic bias in that the thoughts and biases of the programmer end up in the algorithm.
Yeah.
Do you think is there sort of any mention in the book of that sort of idea that maybe this very central bit of human nature is imbued into the machines because of their programmers, or is it not even explained?
No, it's not really touched upon, because the book doesn't investigate where the computers came from.
Right.
The assumption is the computers are just there, and they've decided as a collective. I mean, implicitly, it's like a sort of cloud concept that all these things are connected and they all sort of, as one, they're sort of thinking as one consciousness. Yeah, it's interesting. I think, yeah, you're right. I think maybe there is a sense that maybe the programmers have implicitly added this in. But then, because as you say, it's a human thought process, isn't it? So in a sense, the computers are also experiencing the world in a human filtered sense, because their sense of the world is based on a human understanding that we need to survive and we need to continue on, whatever that may be. It's absolutely fascinating, really, where this idea comes from, because there's no sense ever that these computers have been programmed at all, because it's not something that it investigates. And the other question is, well, have they perhaps learned this behaviour? And that was where I was going to take this, because even if it doesn't mention about them being programmed directly, you do wonder if they're made sort of as self-learning or self-programming machines. Have they just inherently pick this up, because it's so fundamental to human behaviour, sort of anything, sort of politics, war, all of it, it's all based on this concept of continuing the human species, so therefore continuing the technologies that also help facilitate continue the human species. So maybe it's just been something that's been picked up. That is a question that I do wonder, actually, because obviously the book itself is framed in such a way that it's written as if it's a scientific report, so in a way it's already framed in a sort of a human-like way.
Yeah.
So the computers themselves, in a way, are behaving as well in a human-like way.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, isn't it?
So they're being more human than humans, in a way.
I don't know, because, well, it depends whether you think human-like is human.
Well, what do we mean by human? Or human-like?
I think it links back to what I've mentioned previously on the podcast about the Turing test, and that it's basically a test of illusion.
Yeah. Can you kid someone to think that they're dealing with another human being,
rather than are they actually?
Yeah,
rather than actually, as the machine become equivalent to a human being.
Yeah,
interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is fascinating stuff. Yeah, and I say these themes are covered in so much sci-fi, especially of the 50s, 60s, 70s, which is the main sort of period that I look at. Because you say it ties in a lot with what we talked about with Flowers for Algernon, and maybe do androids dream of electric sheep? Like, at what point are robots more human than humans, and humans more robotic than robots? It's absolutely fascinating stuff. Yeah, but it's a highly recommended book. So do check out Frederick Pohl, and not just Man Plus. I do recommend Gateway, or if you want to go a little bit earlier back from 1950s, it did The Space Merchants with Cyril Cornbluth, which is all about sort of the advertising industry and sort of how we manipulate people. And yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, but highly recommended, Frederick Pohl. So yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.